Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today, again, our guest is award-winning columnist and author, Robert J. Samuelson. Robert has written a column for the Washington Post since 1977 and for Newsweek since 1984. He has also authored several books, including his most recent work, The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Influence. Robert, welcome back.
Nice to be back with you, Bruce.
In your book, one of the main theses is the rise and fall of high inflation was the most significant event of the past 50 years. When most people think of the fall of inflation, they think of a very short period of time, maybe to the mid-80s, and then we were sort of back to business as usual. And I think one of your key points is that there was nothing usual about the last 25 years.
Well, my view is that the fall of inflation was almost as important, or perhaps even more important, than the rise of inflation. So just to recap very briefly, in the early 1980s, inflation was double digits. It was reaching levels of 14-15%. You had very high interest rates. Mortgage rates were 14-16% for a 30-year fixed mortgage. The prime rate from banks on loans to their best customers got over 20%. When inflation came down, interest rates came down slowly, because people didn't believe inflation was going to come down and stay down, because it hadn't for the previous 15 years. And as interest rates came down, asset prices, beginning with the stock market, went up. You have to remember that in 1982, the stock market, even without any adjustment for inflation, was essentially at the level it was in 1965. It was the Dow Jones Industrial Average was between 800 and 900. You had an explosion in the stock market over the next 20 years, almost 20 years, so that by 2000, the market was over 10,000 by the Dow. Stock market wealth went of households went from about $1 trillion in 1980 to over $11 trillion at the end of the 90s. So there's enormous explosion in the stock market, in stock values, and later in real estate prices. Consumers felt wealthier. They spent more of their income. They borrowed more. And for many years, there was nothing unreasonable or irrational about any of this behavior, and it propelled the economy. There were only two very modest recessions during this period, 1990-91 and 2001. But the very fact of all this sustained prosperity and all this increase in wealth made people very careless, complacent, and it essentially conditioned people, including very sophisticated people in financial markets, to begin taking risks that they shouldn't have taken, and doing things that were self-defeating, because they believed that the economy had entered into a period of prolonged and uninterrupted prosperity, when that prosperity was fundamentally driven by the forces of disinflation.
You had a comment in your book called preordained success. If you have that kind of a feeling about any investment, it would seem like you would be ignoring a lot of the risk factors that you might normally pay attention to.
People thought that they understood risk, and I think they thought two things. One is that risk had gone down, that the consequence of lower inflation and a commitment to lower inflation had reduced risk both in the economy and in the financial system. And secondly, I think that they felt, as a result of that, that they understood risk better, so that it was less risk to deal with, and they understood it better. And so people then began taking more risk because they didn't think it was risky. Lenders started lending to people who shouldn't have taken on the levels of debt that they should have. They did it under with interest rate conditions that were silly, I think, and destructive, and people invested in the stock market, especially in the 90s when you got the sort of the tech bubble and the stock market bubble. They just assumed that prices would go up inexorably. I remember at the time, in the late 90s, I was writing columns saying, you know, this can't go on. I mean, this is just nutty. And for a number of years, these warnings, which, and I was certainly not alone in this, these warnings did not come true. The market kept going up, and I would write columns apologizing to people for giving them this advice, but saying, this still can't go on. Sooner or later, it's going to stop.
So
and it's probably going to stop with pretty bad effects. And people would look at me with pity because, I was not partaking of the stock market boom that everybody else was partaking of. And they, it just couldn't happen.
So
it just couldn't go on.
The this time it's different crowd had their way for a while.
Well, that's why you get this kind of crowd psychology, and because everybody does believe that this time is different, and you got to kind of get a bandwagon effect.
Another quote that you have that I really enjoyed was, "Great gains inspire perverse behavior," and that's in fact what was going on. Real estate investors, I mean, that's the niche that we happen to see. There were people that owned 50 and 60 homes that didn't even have a normal job with a $30,000 a month negative cash flow. And they would show you that list of properties with great pride because they had a net worth of $4 million.
And that their whole idea, I assume, was that they were going to be able to sell a sucker that he was even dumber than they were.
That's right.
Yeah.
I remember looking at one of those lists, and I just shook my head. I said, isn't this concern you a little bit? No. And that was the gain had created the behavior, and it was they were assured that they were correct. What would you say happened to the expectation of the typical American family in say 2002 to 2007? We were in that bad mood of 79. What were the expectations before the bubble burst?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that people had become so their expectations were so high that it allowed them to grumble during most of the early period of this decade that things weren't good enough.
I think that's a fantastic insight.
But the paradox here is that they could have only grumbled that way if they thought that they were kind of headed for a paradise. And the fact that they weren't quite in paradise, but things were pretty good, allowed them to criticize the actual conditions. And so when historians look back at this episode, unless they are sensitive to this, they will conclude that things were not very good in the early years of this century, when in fact they were quite good, but they weren't as good as people thought they should be, and therefore you got a lot of grumbling and people took shortcuts to make them better, make things better along the lines of where they thought they should be.
You know, what's interesting, too, is that if we didn't enjoy 2000 to, say, 2007, part of it might have been is we forgot the pain of the 70s. Is that too far in our distance?
No, I don't think that. I think that I did a calculation, and I have to go look in the book, but my calculation was I think that roughly two-thirds of today's population was too young in 1980. Either they weren't alive at all, or they were 4, 5, 8. I think I put it up to sort of 17 or 18, where they really were not connected to sort of the economy. You know, they lived with their parents, or they just
weren't aware that
they just weren't aware of it. So that a large part of the population simply doesn't remember the 70s at all, or the high inflation. But even among people who lived through it, my contemporaries, I was born in 1945, so I'm now in almost my mid-60s. Even among my contemporaries, people forget about this. It's really been forgotten entirely. And a columnist I know recently wrote a piece about Reagan's leadership virtues, which I thought was quite correct, but he doesn't mention inflation at all. I mean, I say in the book that this history is the lost history, and I've become increasingly convinced once the book was published that, in fact, this history is lost. People don't remember it, and professional historians and economists have engaged in an act, and political pundits have engaged in an act of collective, maybe unintentional, amnesia. And so the history is just kind of, you know, fading into I don't know what.
That makes it a little scary because you're much more likely to replicate the mistakes.
I think it's important to get the history right for two reasons. One is it's just important to get it right. It's just truth is important. You can never really ultimately achieve it, but you have to be striving for it. So I just think it's important to get the truth for its own sake. But also, if we don't remember these episodes, we risk repeating the same mistakes. And as I mentioned on the previous segment, there are now some very prominent economists, including some Nobel Prize winners, who say, well, a little bit more inflation would be okay. And my reaction to that is, if we sanction a little bit more inflation, we will discover, to our horror, that we didn't get just a little bit more inflation. We got probably a lot more inflation, or we got disruption in the financial markets that was completely unanticipated by the authors of this idea.
When a society is used to good times, is it harder to ask for sacrifices that might be necessary going forward?
Well, it depends on what kind of sacrifices you're asking for and why. I think today, and I've written about this for decades now, it's all been futile, but it's clear today that we have made more promises to more people than we can sensibly afford to keep. And most of those promises are to retirees through Social Security, Medicare, and to a lesser extent, Medicaid. And the cost of paying for those programs as the baby boomers, my generation, retires, is going to be staggering. And it means that our children are going to be saddled either with very high taxes, budget deficits that at some point become unsustainable and trigger some sort of a crisis, or draconian cuts in other government services, many of which are needed. If you explain that to people, or a president explain that to people, maybe they would accept some sacrifices. And by sacrifices, I mean we would have to cut back on Social Security benefits for some of the wealthier retirees. We would have to raise eligibility ages for some of these programs because life expectancy is increased. At some point, we'll also have to raise taxes. I mean, anybody who does the arithmetic, it's just impossible, even with cuts in Social Security and Medicare, to balance the budget without some sort of a tax increase. So it's not a pleasant future that our children are being faced with. And none of our political leaders have really made the case for sacrifice in our collective self-interest, and all of them just seem to be waiting for some sort of crisis to happen which forces them to do things that they know they should have done on their own.
It seems to be the popular conception that inflation or hyperinflation is the likely outcome of, I don't know what time frame, the next 20 years. But in a shorter view, I don't see how inflation emerges from the scenario that we have right now. And so I'm more worried about short-term deflation. Is that, can you?
I tend to agree with you. I don't see, when you have 10% unemployment and you have huge surplus, excess factory capacity, empty office buildings, empty shopping malls, or closed, shuttered stores and shopping malls, and you just go down the list of the sort of what is excess supply, how you get higher inflation out of that, with one proviso: as long as the people running economic policy in this country, meaning the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Board and people at the White House, don't come to the conclusion that higher inflation is better, that for some reason it's a good thing. If they do that, you can have higher inflation in periods when you have poor economic growth. I mean,
stagflation.
We had it in the 70s. But absent that, and if you assume the determination to keep inflation down, I don't see where we're going to have higher inflation in the near term. Now,
what is your version of near term, would you think?
Oh, next 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
Three to 5 years, I would say.
Okay.
But again, an important proviso. Now, the long term, we have a staggering debt, and maybe people say, well, we'll inflate our way out of it. The trouble is, it's not easy to inflate your way out of the debt because most of our debt is fairly short term. So I think 40—I'd have to go check, but I think 40% of it turns over in a year or two.
Yeah, about 75 in 4 years.
And so, you know, if you raise the inflation rate, you don't really erode this debt because you just have to refinance it at much higher interest rates. So in theory, that seems like a good idea, or at least it seems like a practical choice. Not a good idea, but it's at least a choice. But in practice, it probably is not even a realistic choice.
Japan has certainly tried to do a little bit of that, and they don't seem to have been able to inflate, yet they had increased money supply. So do we have any correlation between their experience and what we're going through or about to?
Well, I think that a mistake that is made widely by economists is to assume that the economy responds in a mechanical way to monetary and fiscal policies. Monetary policies meaning the supply of credit and interest rates, and fiscal policy meaning government spending and taxes. And I think these have huge influences on the economy, but I don't think they're everything. And I think what happened in Japan is that the Japanese had an economic model which they followed really from the beginning of the 50s to the middle 80s, and it worked very well for them. They had an export-led economy, investment based on successful export industries. For most of that time, they had an undervalued exchange rate, and their domestic economy was not that dynamic, but their export sector was, and it kind of kept growth high and kept investment high. Once that model became outmoded in the mid-80s because the exchange rate appreciated dramatically and their exports became less competitive, the Japanese basically settled into a very low growth mode, and they haven't been able to find another economic model that gives them better results. And contrary to what people learn in college economics, monetary and fiscal policy are not able to change that. And so their efforts to expand their economy with large budget deficits and very loose monetary policy simply didn't work against an economic structure that had very, it was not dynamic. It was dynamic internationally, but not domestically. And I think that's the fundamental problem in Japan, and it's really beyond the purview of traditional economic policy.
We talked a little bit about the expectation, and if inflation was the expectation, that resulted in some things. What if deflation is, in fact, what's anticipated? How do you know?
Well, that if deflation became anticipated, it would be very destructive, which is why the Fed and other central banks have been so aggressive in trying to prevent that from happening. I don't think modest price decreases for a little while would be all that bad. They might be. You just don't know. But if people get the idea that prices are going to decline forever, then it is a problem, because people won't borrow because their debt burdens will rise, because the value of the money they earn will decrease, and they'll postpone buying because the car that they could buy for $28,000 today will sell for $18,000 in 18 months or whatever. They will put off purchases as long as possible, and that will tend to reduce demand. And if that reduces demand, unemployment will go up. People will become more pessimistic. They will tend. It's not a good scenario.
What's changed about the expectation of the baby boom generation for retirement? What'd you say?
Well, you now ask the question. It's a little bit beyond my competence because I.
But you are one.
I'm at the very edge of it. I'm 65. Right. I was born in 45. I'll be 65 in December.
Okay.
My own view is that my retirement has become much more chancy,
okay,
uncertain, and much more. I saved quite a bit. I'm not extravagant, and I saved a fair amount. But one of the things you learned, or presumably you learned over the last 10 or 12 years, is that markets don't always go up. And if you have X on Thursday, 6 months from Thursday, you might have X minus 30%.
Mm-hmm.
And if you thought that X was adequate to get you to your deathbed, X minus 30% might not be adequate, or at least might not be adequate to allow you to live the life you thought you were entitled to.
Well, and you know why I asked the question was not specifically for you, but in other words, that whole generation is probably feeling exactly that way, and that's going to set up something that doesn't seem very inflationary to me.
When I talk to economists, you have one group of economists, and they may be correct here. They say people's memories are short, and they think that if we get into a reasonably fast-growing economy for 3 or 4 years, that people will tend to snap out of this. I don't know. I think I'm more inclined to be with you that some of these setbacks were sufficiently severe and sufficiently surprising that people are scarred.
The other thing is the source of our GDP growth. You know, you mentioned something in your book about that we were really the benefactor of these kind of large chunks of profit. So we had the stock market up to 2000, then we had the real estate market, and we really became accustomed to withdrawing equity, for instance. Most of the GDP growth after 2002 came directly from equity growth and extraction of it.
So a lot of it came from the fact that people were basically living beyond their means in one way or another.
Right, but they had access to money on a home. So I wonder what's going to fuel all this GDP growth going forward. Ultimately my challenge is sitting here going, okay, I'm not sure how we get inflation if we're going to have a hard time just having a moderate GDP growth.
Well, in an ideal world, I'm not saying we're going into this world, in an ideal world, the source of growth for the next 10 years or 15 or whatever would be higher exports, fewer imports, producing more things in this country as opposed to buying them abroad, and investment related to those things. Plus, I would say, more investment in our energy infrastructure, by which I do not mean primarily solar or wind, although there'll be some of that, but more in domestic natural gas, particularly, of which we have now discovered we have a lot more than we thought we had, and also oil. And that we need to be producing more for ourselves and buying less abroad and selling more abroad. And that is, in theory, an engine of potential economic growth. Whether it will materialize in practice, I don't know. I'm somewhat dubious. But in theory, that's where it should come from.
We just have a couple more minutes. You mentioned that at the turn of after the Great Depression, after the World War, you spoke of a pact between the government and big business. Is there another pact that you see today, and who are their participants?
Well, I don't see another pact today. And the pact that I talked about was informal and unstated.
Correct.
And it was political and psychological, and it was sort of understood. But, you can't find a piece of paper anywhere that has this on it. And basically, after World War II, businesses did not want to be reviled the way they had been during the Great Depression. And so they submitted to social and economic regulation in return for continued freedom, market freedoms, but not as much as they had had before. What we should have today is a kind of new generational pact in which the retirees, the baby boomers and even some non-baby boomers who are older, basically agree to reduce some of their benefits so that we take the huge burden of paying for these benefits off the shoulders of the young and allow them to start businesses, to start families, to have children, and to live in a way that a significant chunk of their income isn't being drained off to support their parents and grandparents.
I completely agree with that.
That's what we should be doing. I mean, there are plenty of people who can afford to pay much more of their own retirement as opposed to being subsidized by their children and grandchildren.
Robert, we've run out of time. Robert Samuelson has created one heck of a book, The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Influence. Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.